Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Kavanagh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Last time we finished our discussion of structure in Little Women, and today we're going to talk about structure in Jane Eyre. We should move on to
Jane Eyre,
an autobiography, which is actually the full title of the novel, by the way, Jane Eyre, an autobiography. And I find that absolutely fascinating that the title is not true. It's not an autobiography. It's a novel. It's fiction. It's a first-person narrative novel written as, quote, you know, I'm doing air quotes now, autobiography, which is so fun and fascinating. And like all our other books, the thoughts and the dialogue from the characters' thoughts and feelings works kind of in a circular way. The characters' thoughts and feelings inform how we see them and how they grow through the story. So the dialogue that we hear them speak, if you will, hear them speak, and the thoughts that they have that we read on the page gives us insight into them. I think when we do workshops, we could look closely at the two prefaces to the second and third editions for really good commentary from Currier Bell, who is, you know, I think everybody, no spoilers, I think everybody knows that was the original name that Charlotte Bronte used when she had this book published. They're just fascinating to me. I mean, the gushing ode to Thackeray is just like, what? You know. But if you read that, then it kind of informs on some of the characters and the story, which we'll talk about later. You know, we'll end up talking about that a little bit later. But basically, kind of like the other books that at least two of the other books that we've chosen, the stages of life, growth from childhood to adulthood, Jane Eyre, Little Women, Gone with the Wind, all do that. Dracula, not so much, but that's, you know, we do have some evolution and growth in Dracula as well. But I think this one is as probably closest to Little Women in terms of starting in childhood and moving through young adulthood. Like Gone with the Wind, though, at the end of Little Women and the end of Jane Eyre, our protagonists are not very old, you know. We're talking about young adults, okay? So that's important to remember. Sometimes we get to thinking these are, you know, people who are actually older than they really are.
That's true, because even though there's a tiny chapter that's flash forward 10 years at the end of Jane Eyre, she can't be more than 28, 29. She hasn't reached 30 yet.
At the end of the 10 years, not at the end of the story.
Right.
I mean, yeah. She's still, yeah, I would say she's still under 30, you know, because at the end of the main part of the story, I don't think she's more than 19 or 20 years old.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Which is mind-boggling, just as when I read Gone with the Wind and realize that, you know, Atlanta burns and Scarlet is how old or how young, you know, I mean, things like that, you know, it's a little bit like, whoa. Jump back from the image of Vivian Leigh or, you know, name someone who's played Jane Eyre, you know, the image of Joan Fontaine or whoever, you know, it's
Emma
like,
Clark.
Yeah, I mean, those were grown up. I mean, you know, Vivian Leigh, lovely as she was and as beautifully as she represented that character, she was a grown up woman in her 30s. Okay. Playing a 16 to 26 year old person. And, you know, there's no scene in Gone with the Wind where she looks 16. I'm sorry. Not even a sex object 16. She still looks like a fully grown woman, you know, so. Anyway, but I do think Jane Eyre is similar to Little Women in that it goes from true childhood. I mean, it starts out, Jane is very, very young at the beginning. Oh, sorry, I'm having such an itchy nose today. I just keep sniveling. But tell me, let's talk more about impact of the structure. Let's get back to our question of impact of the structure on the novel.
Sure, absolutely. And when you were talking about how both Little Women and Jane Eyre reflect so much on childhood, I love the fact that we spend so much time on Jane's childhood. I'll get to proportions later.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that Alcott has a better grasp of what real children speak like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels much truer to me than it does in Jane Eyre. Yeah. Sometimes it seems like a legit kid reaction.
Isn't that so interesting, though? Because if you think about the two authors, Louisa May Alcott and Charlotte Bronte, both came from families with siblings. Mm-hmm. Both came from families that had a fairly isolated, their fathers were very intellectual. They had the people that they knew from their father's friends and the circle of intelligent literary people, very similar in that regard. Mm-hmm. And yet, like you said, their writing style, and although both Jane Eyre and Little Women are both kind of moralistic in tone, the perspective of how to write children, you know, and make them seem authentic, very different.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to note.
And from what I know of the Brontes, they were rather precocious, so maybe they really did talk like that. But I've never thought that Helen Byrne sounded like any real living 12-year-old.
No, she is some. I mean, she's even more. She surpasses Beth in her, you know, wise wisdom beyond her ages. I mean, my goodness, she's just like a, what do you call that? The like a Buddhist monk on top of a mountain or something. I mean, she's like a shaman, you know? I mean, she's just like, what? She says these things that is like, what?
She's giving little sermons.
Did they do an IQ test on her? Because she would have been like off the charts, you know?
Yeah.
She's an interesting character, and nothing like the Elizabeth Taylor, the famous Elizabeth Taylor, played her as a child in the Jane Eyre that I referenced with, I believe it was Joan Fontaine and was it Orson Welles who played?
Yes, and he never blinks. Yes.
Yeah. Orson Welles played Rochester. But yeah, and I loved it. It's, again, I had a fascination with children dying young in movies and books when I was little. I wonder why. But I mean, I loved Elizabeth Taylor in that part. But when I read the book, I'm like, that's not what? You know, they really changed that character for Elizabeth Taylor. They made it a very different character than what we have in the book. Mm-hmm. And she became a much larger, bigger character than what's in the book, I think. But I think in the book, you know, the first person narrative is different than our other books, except in, if you want to say, like in the Dracula books, when some of the characters are, we have them through their journals or something, mm-hmm. and those are in first person. But I think this is the one that's the most, you know, just completely, well, it's like I said, the subtitle is an autobiography. I mean, right. You know,
right. Yeah, and I don't tend to enjoy first-person novels nearly as much as I do for third,
yeah.
But I think it really works for Jane, because it is so very much her story. She shows so much character growth,
mm-hmm.
and hearing it from her makes it very much more personal. I felt like her confidant in reading it.
Oh, I see, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it also, I think, helps us as readers believe her when she's like, no, romance with Rochester, that's just not possible. We believe her.
Mm-hmm.
We believe her. Whereas I think that if it were done in a third person, we'd be like, no.
Yeah.
It'll work out.
Yeah.
True love will conquer all.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that because when I read this book, and I'm trying to think of another first-person novel if I've had the same reaction, and just nothing's coming into my brain-dead head at the moment. But when I read this book, my reaction to Jane's narration, you said, I love that you said you felt like her confidant. I kept wanting to, like, slap her and argue with her. You know, I was like, no, don't think that. No, don't think that. Oh, my God, don't do that. You know, it's like, you know, so that's kind of funny. But there were also a lot of times when I truly felt for her, and I truly sympathized with her point of view, and I totally understood why she thought what she thought in a lot of scenes, a lot of chapters, even though I didn't agree with her thoughts.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
I like what you say in the notes about the sounds from the attic, so don't forget to say that part.
I will not forget. And it occurs to me, too, that since we chose Dracula and Jane Eyre, the mystery part pairs really well with the first person, because with a mystery, having a character who only has part of the clues or who is misinterpreting the clues is wonderful to also keep us as a reader, like, we sort of get it. Oh, wait, no, we don't.
Exactly. And
so I like that. That's
what makes
kind
a good
of
mystery
part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It makes a great mystery.
If the reader, I mean, one of the things I've found myself, you know, when I watch movies or anything, if I can predict what's going to happen, I'm bored. You know, I'm like, well, this was a fine movie. It was utterly predictable. That's my review. You know,
right.
And I think books are the same way. If we're reading and we know the answer before the answer is told to us, that's kind of disappointing, you know. And I think Jane Eyre, you and I are both so familiar with this book. We've read it so many times that we're not surprised now, but try to go back and remember the first time you ever read it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does keep you guessing. And the way, even the way Grace Poole is presented, helps keep that mystery and everything alive for us.
It gave it really good rereading value this time, because I just reread the chapter where spoilers again for 150-year-old book.
Yeah.
But I just read the chapter again where Bertha Mason, the wife in the attic,
mm-hmm.
she has come downstairs. She has set Mr. Rochester's room on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Jane only knows that something has happened. She doesn't know it was Bertha. She doesn't even know who Bertha is.
She doesn't even know there is a Bertha at this point.
Exactly.
Right, at that point, she doesn't even know there is a Bertha.
Right. And so she is under the assumption that it must have been this mysterious servant, Grace Poole, and
mm-hmm.
she's talking to her the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And it had such good reread value, because the first time through reading it, you're like, okay, the way Grace is answering this, she's hiding secrets. You can tell she is. She's answering slowly because she's the one.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who did all this.
Mm-hmm.
And that reread value, you're like, it's because she's keeping the secret about Bertha.
Right.
And it had such great reread value.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's so true. And I think Charlotte Bronte does a great job of keeping Jane's brain, her thoughts, right in our forefront. We are right there with Jane every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we learn, you know, other people's perspectives, other characters' perspectives, and what they were thinking when this happened or whatever, we keep Jane we're right there with her. We're seeing everything through her eyes first.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we'll continue our discussion of structure in Jane Eyre.
This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.